of Imam al-Sahib al-Asri wal-Zaman because of our remembrance of Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. Inshallah, until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
That was the program Hadith of the Day on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Yasser Ibrahim, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
This one lay.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello, welcome to The Spotlight. The 20-year Afghanistan war has ended in what some have described as a humiliating defeat for the U.S. Even though the U.S. president may state otherwise, other leaders, like the Russian president, have said that the campaign ended in only tragedies and only losses. The Iranian president has said that the war spelled aggression and human rights violations. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will review America's legacy after two decades of war, occupation, and conflict. Joining us for guests for this edition is activist, author, and a member of the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism from Answer Coalition, Richard Becker. We also have international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda, who joins us from Moscow. Okay, I'd like to welcome you both. Let me first start with you, Richard Becker, if I may. First, you have the speech by the U.S. President Joe Biden, in which he said it was an extraordinary success, the evacuation of the Kabul airport. Offered no apologies for either his decision to end the war or in the way that his administration actually executed that. And also, in some respects, though not 100%, he said that the war was a success. Why would he give that kind of impression on this war that many have stated to be otherwise?
Well, I think that one thing that we've learned about our politicians is that they'll say anything that they think is in their own self-interest. The latest phase of the U.S. war in Afghanistan it began nearly 20 years ago. It could have ended in November of 2001 when the Taliban leadership basically offered to surrender if given, and their only condition was amnesty. But, we've seen the arrogance, the hubris of imperial arrogance that has been manifested by every administration since then, from George W. Bush through Barack Obama, Donald Trump, and now Biden. All lies, lie after lie after lie, misrepresentation after misrepresentation. And meanwhile, we've seen enormous suffering on the part of the people of Afghanistan, of the soldiers who were sent to fight and die and kill from the United States and other countries, the loss of resources. It's estimated now by various sources that the war will end up costing between $4.965 trillion and $5.8 trillion dollars, and it may go much higher than that. That kind of money could have solved all the problems of the people of Afghanistan and much of the world, but it's gone. It's gone into the pockets of corrupt politicians, and it's gone up in smoke on the battlefield. And now where are we? We're right back where we were in September of 2001 in terms of who is the government of Afghanistan. So to say, in any respect, in any way to try to claim that that is a victory or that is success, I think just emphasizes what I started out saying, that the politicians will say anything.
Sure. Well, Mark Sloboda, you're there in Moscow. The Russian president has spoken on this occasion, and let me quote him when he said, for 20 years the American forces were present on this territory. For 20 years they tried, as we can say without offense to anyone, to civilize the people who live there, to instill their own norms and standards of life in the widest possible sense of this word, including when it comes to the political organization of society. The result is only tragedies. Does he have a point?
Well, absolutely. And what the Russian president was saying was not altogether different from actually what Joe Biden was saying. Both, to some extent, were decrying the idea of invasive nation-building military operations. Obviously, the Russian president was expressing it in much stronger terms, but those are exactly the same justifications that Joe Biden used for his withdrawal of military forces and his ending after two decades of the military conflict in Afghanistan. And I think my colleague was dead on the money when he spoke of hubris. And the Russian president is well aware of this because of the Soviet intervention in Afghanistan, in the failure of a socialist nation building there. Now, at the time, there already was a socialist government that was under siege by U.S.-backed, armed, and salaried jihadists, mujahideen. But the situation is much the same at the end result, albeit, you know, the government that the Soviet Union left behind when they withdrew lasted for another 3 years and only eventually collapsed when the Soviet Union dissolved itself and was unable to continue financial aid there. But it's almost a trope, but it is also a truism that Afghanistan has been the graveyard of empires because of this hubristic idea of going in and changing the Afghan people, installing a foreign political, social, and value system. And the Russian president spoke of the need, for understanding the existing people's history, culture, and values. Despite Joe Biden decrying this nation building now, he supported it previously when he was a senator on the Foreign Relations Committee in the United States in the height of the Afghan war. The U.S. obviously still hasn't learned its lessons because it still has a military occupation force in Iraq against the express wishes of the Iraqi parliament. It still has military occupation forces illegally in East Syria. It is still conducting a war on terror operations all across Africa and the Middle East. We can only hope that, Joe Biden reflects further on these continuing hubristic U.S. military operations in pursuit of global hegemony, as he has so tragically learned eventually from the events in Afghanistan.
Well, if we were to take a look at the whole situation in terms of the period of time that this took for it to happen, Richard Becker, when we say 20 years, there's a certain sense of what was translating on the ground, aside from any nation building that's supposed to have happened or any reconstruction, the fact that the military side of it should have proven to be successful in any regards. That is one of the biggest questions and the most repeated questions that is asked, at least based on the type of exposure that I've had, as to how can the U.S. that claims to have the biggest, the most effective, incredible army in the world not able to defeat the Taliban in the course of 20 years? What was going on there?
You know, it's a very interesting question, and it's a very important question. Matthew Ho, who has become an anti-war activist, but who was in the State Department, said a number of years ago, made this statement. He said, the more the U.S. troops take action inside Afghanistan, this isn't a direct quote, but I think it's close, the more resistance fighters there are. And we can understand that if we saw the way the war was really conducted, that, you know, there was a great deal of the same kind of thing that went on in Iraq, which is the night raids, where, you know, the patrol comes and busts in the door of a family's house, it terrorizes the people in the house, and maybe it drags away one or more of the members of the household. They end up in a Bagram prison or another prison where they're tortured and abused. And they become, even if they weren't before, they become the active opponents, enemies of the occupation forces. That's very understandable. I think everyone should think about what is it like to live under occupation, and what's the response of the people who are living under occupation. Do they like the occupiers? Well, maybe a few of them do, but the great majority of them resent the fact that their country is under foreign occupation and that they're treated the way that they're treated by the occupying troops. So that's the reality is that the form of the warfare created more and more and more resistance, and it wasn't only there, it was also in Iraq, it's also been in other countries. But this is the idea, and the idea to wage war in this way is it grows out of a fundamental form of racism, that we can do whatever we want, is the attitude of the occupiers. We can do whatever we want to these people because they're inferior to us, and we're superior to them, and we can crush them. And we've seen, you know, from the war in Vietnam to the wars in Iraq and there's been two of those, that, you know, and now the war in Afghanistan, that the reaction is the opposite of what the commanders and occupying forces expect. It's one that their repression, if it doesn't crush the people altogether, will result in greater and greater resistance. And I think that's what we've witnessed the victory of a resistance movement. I'm not a supporter of the Taliban. I think they have very reactionary policies and social policies in many respects. But they are an indigenous resistance movement, and the fact that they were able to achieve victory is due to the fact that they are just that. They are of the people of Afghanistan.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Couple of interesting points, Mark Sloboda, that our guest, Richard Becker makes, and I want to find out from you whether this is indeed what has occurred. You know, this war on terror began back in 2001, officially with the invasion of Afghanistan. And then throughout that time, the U.S., of course, was engaged in other wars also. For example, lots of drone strikes that happened in Pakistan. But basically, the idea that the war on terror actually accelerated resistance fighters, which go against the U.S. That's on the one hand, and then when you take a look at the way that they actually were not successful, whether it's Iraq, Syria, you got Libya. On the other hand, you have Yemen, for example, in terms of their involvement there. How does that make the U.S. look in terms of the way that it's conducted the so-called war on terror?
Yeah, so first of all, the United States does have the largest, best-funded, best-armed conventional military force in the world. And it's very, very good at taking on another state's armies and overthrowing governments. It's done that quite well in Iraq and in Afghanistan. It drove the Taliban out within a couple of weeks, almost as fast as the Taliban took back the country once U.S. forces withdrew. But when they are tasked with this, the term is no nation building. You know, it's a form of colonialism. They don't understand the native cultures, and invariably they are viewed as an alien occupying force with foreign values. And American troops, they don't understand the cultures, the language, and they do generate insurgency from the native population, often simply by their presence and their attempt to install a foreign political system and values. This becomes a self-perpetuating conflict, which is what, the war on terror very quickly morphed into. It became a war on tribal Islam in parts of the Islamic world where there was resistance to U.S. military occupation. And then, of course, we have the hypocrisy as well, because the so-called war on terror, at the same time the U.S. was supporting Islamists and jihadists when it was to their interests, in Libya and Syria. And we're talking forces that are directly linked, allied with, embedded with, politically connected with al-Qaeda. I don't know how you explain that to the American people, except by not talking about it at all, not acknowledging the truth of that, because the American people, if they understood that, would of course recoil. I mean, from the forces, that they are told struck them on 9/11. We see this war on terror thus revealed not even so much as the war on tribal Islam, but a war for hegemony, a war for the pursuit of hegemony around the world, particularly in the Islamic world in North Africa, that was resisted in many areas. The best successes they had were by supporting jihadist forces in different areas. And that contradiction, lies at the heart of U.S. foreign policy errors and blowback dating back to, the 1980s when the U.S. was supporting the Mujahideen that would eventually morph into the Taliban and al-Qaeda themselves. So unless the U.S. learns these lessons, this hubris, this pursuit of hegemony, at whatever cost and whatever allies they make or use along the way, then we're just unfortunately going to see this continue, as the U.S. press is already talking up the shift to military confrontation with China on the other side of the Pacific, in the South China Sea, or in the Taiwan Straits. It seems that very little has been learned.
Well, I mean, how can that be the view of the U.S. when they have suffered the defeat that they have in Afghanistan, even if there are people, officials, or whomever in power that maybe doesn't believe so, and yet want to confront China militarily or threaten Iran, for example? I mean, how can the U.S. portray its strength when it suffered the way it did in Afghanistan, especially that it couldn't even execute a proper withdrawal from an airport?
Yes. Well, I think that what the U.S. is turning away from is the so-called nation building toward nation destroying. I think that the withdrawal of from the forces in Afghanistan the wind down of the U.S., some of the, not completely, but some of the U.S. Engagement in the Middle East is meant to facilitate the concentration of forces against China in particular. But you can see that the U.S. policy right now against a number of countries is really aimed at destruction. And I'm talking about Cuba, the tightening of the blockade, which is causing great suffering inside Cuba in the midst of the pandemic, the sanctions being ratcheted up against Iran, against Venezuela, against Nicaragua, and of course, from a military point of view, day in, day out, if you follow the military websites, you see the preparation for war against China is going on. So this is a shift, and I think that the Biden administration is counting on the idea that this will be over with, that generally more people want the U.S. out of Afghanistan, a pretty strong majority, and that this will pass by. And meanwhile, the preparation for the most dangerous kind of war anyone can imagine is going forward at a very rapid pace. And this is, so the U.S. strategy, the objective, we are told, is that we must defeat China in the battle for the 21st century. But we should really think, the people of the United States and the people of China have no such interest in this, and I don't think the Chinese government wants to get in that kind of competition either. I know that they don't. But the U.S. government is propagandizing us to prepare us for a new war. Whether or not that war comes to pass or not, we certainly hope not. But this idea that we the people should be thinking about our competition with China, we have no interest in a competition with China. We have an interest in friendship and solidarity and cooperation with other countries to face things like global pandemics and climate change and so forth. But instead, what the government of the United States is doing, and the Biden administration is really a kind of neocon administration, is trying to prepare us for the most terrible kind of war that any of us can imagine.
Mark Sloboda, I mean, come on, let's really be realistic. I mean, you talked about the U.S. and how it's going for this military confrontation. I mean, what could China be thinking based on the way that Afghanistan went down and the withdrawal that happened? And not only that, you had Kamala Harris, the VP that was in that region, trying to muster up and rally nations in that region behind the U.S. That it kind of gets a stamp of approval to go after China, militarily perhaps. What are those nations thinking when it's their backyard and here the U.S. is moving full steam ahead? I mean, hasn't this Afghanistan debacle detracted, obviously, from the way that they see the U.S. being an effective force against China?
Well, first of all, the Chinese government, not that it had the same type of hegemonic pretensions that the U.S. did, will certainly take what happened to the United States in Afghanistan as a cautionary tale and a reflection that over, you know, the last 20, 30 years, China has not engaged in that type of military interventions, at great financial and human cost in the world. And when people try to, you know, refer to the coming conflict with China and the United States as an inevitable conflict along the lines of a Thucydides trap, a failing hegemon confronting inevitably a rising hegemon, there's every indication that a powerful China would be qualitatively different than the United States, that they would not suffer from this type of arrogant, imperial, militaristic hubris. U.S. allies that it is attempting to goad into this conflict, hopefully they also view this as a cautionary tale about how quickly they can be thrown to the side.
They are. They are.
The Kurds, whether in Iraq or Syria, would have learned this by now. They seem not to have. The forces that the U.S. supports in Kiev and the Ukraine are another indication of this. India, I mean, the U.S. is using this geopolitical term Indo-Pacific which is, you know, the geopolitical translation of that is the U.S. attempting to dupe 1.4 billion Indians into serving as their cannon fodder in a war with China that India doesn't need. Right. Hopefully they would learn something from this. I don't know if that's evidently, you know, history keeps making the same mistakes again and again.
Yeah, sorry to have jumped in because we're just almost out of time. Last question to you, Richard Becker, in under a minute. You have U.S. allies that are voicing concern, and maybe this time they're going to move ahead with their views, such as the European Union, saying, you know, we can't rely on the U.S. Let's have our own army to go ahead with any type of foreign policy adventures that we might want to get into. Even the U.K. that had its defense minister, or Dominic Raab, being questioned and grilled by Parliament, saying, you know, we shouldn't rely on U.S. intelligence all the time. So are we seeing U.S. allies realizing that, you know, the U.S. isn't always right in terms of the way it goes ahead militarily altogether? Under a minute, if you can.
Well, I think that the U.S. views the allies as really instruments in its global strategy of domination. And particularly in the Asian countries, Japan, Okinawa, Taiwan, Philippines, Borneo, this buildup of forces and what the U.S. military leaders called the first island chain shows us exactly how they look at those countries, that they are military assets, that John Foster Dulles years ago called them unsinkable aircraft carriers. That's a horrific way to think about a country, and it's the way that the U.S. leaders look at these at the other countries as really pawns in their strategy of global domination.
Thank you. We're going to end it there. Activist author and a member of the Act Now to Stop the War and End Racism from Answer Coalition, Richard Becker from San Francisco. And thank you, international affairs and security analyst Mark Sloboda from Moscow. And with that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.
The Last Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us the sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah. To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
In the name of Allah the Almighty, dear brothers and sisters, Salamun Alaikum. This is the Last Savior from IRIB English Radio. As usual, we'll listen to The Last Savior with a new point about doubts and misconceptions on Mahdaviya, Mahdism, and related issues. Dr. Murtaza Karimi, specialist on Islamic theology, is with us today. Today, Mahdi, imaginary figure or real one?
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله وبركاته My dear brothers and sisters all around the world As you know, in this program, The Last Savior, we are talking about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and some of the doubts and misconceptions which are mainly posed and raised by some Wahhabi scholars. In the first program, I referred to one of these doubts and the answer remained incomplete and I promise to continue the answer to the question in today's session and program, inshallah. This Wahhabi scholar claims that according to the scholars of history and genealogy, Hassan ibn Ali, that is Imam Askari alayhi salam, our 11th Imam, he did not live and he did not have any son, any child. So he claims that because of this fact that there is no scholar of history and genealogy to confess the existence and birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, no one, including the Shiite, can claim that Imam Askari alayhi salam had a child and he is the promised Mahdi. In the first program, I said that there are at least two answers to this doubt. First of all, what do you mean by scholars of history and genealogy? Do you mean only the Sunnis or it includes the Shia? When we refer to the Shia scholars, you cannot find even one Shia scholar of hadith, history, genealogy to have ever claimed that Imam Askari alayhi salam did not have any child. All of them, they are in consensus that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born to Imam Askari alayhi salam. And then, as I mentioned, although as Shia we can prove many of our beliefs from the Sunni sources, but we cannot expect the Shia to prove all the details of their beliefs based on Sunni sources. But then the second answer, which is more important, is that this claim is even baseless regarding the Sunni scholars, because many people, they have this impression and idea that because of the fact that according to the Sunnis, Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is not yet born and he will be born in future, they do not believe in a son for Imam Askari alayhi salam. And there is a confusion here. This is, a wrong idea. Although they do not believe in son of Imam Askari alayhi salam as the promised Mahdi, but the point is that when we refer to the history, no one, including the Sunni scholars, can deny, for example, the existence of Imam al-Sadiq alayhi salam or Imam al-Jawad alayhi salam or Imam al-Askari alayhi salam. They have mentioned that and they have talked about some parts of the life of these Imams of the Ahlul Bayt in their books, at least as righteous people. So when it comes to Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, again we see that many Sunni scholars, they have talked about the fact that there was a son for Imam Askari alayhi salam and his name was Muhammad. And let me refer to another point, and that is the fact that we know that the conditions and situations at the time of Imam Askari alayhi salam and Imam Mahdi alayhi salam were very crucial. Agents of the Abbasid Caliphate were looking for the son of Imam Askari alayhi salam to kill him because of the fact that they knew about the narrations of a son for Imam Askari alayhi salam and the fact that he is the savior, he will remove all the oppressors and so on and so forth. So it's very normal that under such situations, the number of the accounts about the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam is less compared to the previous imams. So this is a fact and we cannot ignore it. But given that we mentioned that there are some Sunni scholars of history and genealogy who have mentioned about the existence of a son for Imam Askari alayhi salam. I talked about Ibn al-Athir in his book Al-Kamil, volume 7, page 247. Also Ibn Khalakan in Wafayatul A'yan, volume 4, page 176, in which he also quotes another Sunni scholar, that is Ibn al-Azra. And then I talked about Dhahabi in Siyar al-A'lam al-Nubala, volume 13, page 119. Today I would like to share more information about that and quote from other Sunni scholars in this regard. Himawi is a very famous Sunni scholar of history. He has a famous book, Mu'jam al-Buldan. In volume 4, page 123, he talks about Imam al-Hadi alayhi salam as follows. He says, Ali ibn Muhammad bin Ali ibn Musa ibn Ja'far bin Muhammad ibn Ali ibn al-Husayn bin Ali ibn Abi Talib radiyallahu an. So he mentions the name of Imam Hadi alayhi salam and his father and his forefathers to Imam Ali alayhi salam. Rukanna Abu al-Hasan, his kunya was Abu al-Hasan. He was born in the city of Medina and then he was taken to Samarra. So this is about Imam Hadi alayhi salam. Then he says, Wabnuhu al-Hasan bin Ali. His son Hassan was born in the city of Medina and he was taken to Samarra as well, and that is why they were called Askariyain. Fa'amma Ali famata fi Rajab. This Ali, that is Imam Hadi alayhi salam, he passed away in the month of Rajab, and he talks about the time and place of his death. And then about Imam Askari alayhi salam, he says that Amal Hassan famata bi Samarra aydan. He also passed away in Samarra in the year 260 after Hijrah. They were buried in the city of Samarra. And then he says the following, Wali waladihim al muntazar hunaka mashahid ma'rufa. He has a son, that is for Imam Hadi and Imam Askari, their son, that is Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. He has some places which are very famous in the city of Samarra. Maybe he is referring to Sardab. So you see, this Sunni scholar also is referring to a child for Imam Askari alayhi salam. And he doesn't reject the fact that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was a child for Imam Askari alayhi salam.
Let's have a short break. You are with The Last Savior from IRIB English Radio.
على الذين استضعفوا في الأرض ونجعلهم أئمة ونجعلهم الوارثين.
And we wanted to confer favor upon those who were oppressed in the land, and make them leaders, and make them inheritors.
Welcome back to your listeners. This is IRIB English Radio. Dr. Karimi has spoken about doubts on the existence of Imam al-Mahdi. Now the continuation of the program.
Himawi in Mu'jam al-Buldan, volume 4, page 123, he talks about three Imams of the Shia, that is Imam Hadi, Imam Askari, and Imam Mahdi alayhim assalam. Again, I repeat that it doesn't mean that he believes in them as his imams. Rather, he's only reporting the history. He talks about the fact that Ali ibn Muhammad, that is Imam Hadi alayhi salam, he was born in such and such date and place. Then his son Hassan bin Ali was born and passed away in these dates and places. And then he talks about a child for Imam Askari alayhi salam, and he calls him Al-Muntazar, the awaited one. So that is enough for us to prove that this Sunni scholar also prove and explicitly confesses to the birth and existence of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. The next Sunni scholar in our list is Zirikli in his book Al-A'lam, volume 6, page 80. He again talks about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam himself. He says Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Askari bin Ali al-Hadi. Again, he talks about the genealogy of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam. He is Muhammad, son of Hassan al-Askari, son of Ali al-Hadi. His kunya is Abu al-Qasim. So he mentions his viewpoint, the fact that this Muhammad has a father whose name is Hassan, and a grandfather whose name is Ali, and has a kunya that is Abu al-Qasim. Then he says, آخر الأئمة الاثنى عشر عند الإمامية. He is the last Imam out of the 12th Imam in the eyes of the Shia. So this part, he doesn't believe in that. But he doesn't mean that he doesn't believe in the first part of his statement where he says that Muhammad is the son of Hassan, son of Ali al-Hadi. And then he continues to mention the viewpoints of the Shia, which means that he doesn't believe in them, but he believes in the existence of this person. وَهُوَ الْمَعْرُوفُ عَنْدَهُمْ بِالْمَهْدِ. This is the one who is famous as Mahdi, Sahib al-Zaman, the owner of the time, Al-Muntazar, the awaited, Al-Hujjah, the divine proof. So this is the viewpoint of the Shia. Then again, he mentions what he believes in him. وَلَدَ فِي Samarra. He was born in the city of Samarra. Again, another historical fact. وَمَاتَ أَبُوهُ وَلَهُ مِنَ الْعُمْرِ نَحْوَ خَمْسِ سَنِينَ. When his father passed away, he had only 5 years old. And we know that according to the Shia scholars, this is also a historical fact, because Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born in 255 after Hijrah, and Imam Askari alayhi salam was martyred 5 years later in 260. So this Sunni scholar directly mentions the name of the Imam, the name of his father, the name of his grandfather, his kunya. Then he refers to the viewpoints of the Shia. Then again he refers to the historical facts about the birth of this Imam, the birthplace of him, and his age when his father, that is Imam Askir alayhi salam, passed away. The next one is Ahmad ibn al-Hajar al-Haytami al-Shafi'i, again another Sunni scholar, a prominent one, and his book is very famous, As-Sawa'iq al-Muhraqa. In page 207, he talks about Imam Askari alayhi salam. He says Abu Muhammad, that is Imam Askari alayhi salam, was born in the year 232 after Hijra, except for his son Abu al-Qasim Muhammad al-Hujja, who was only 5 years old when his father passed away, this Hassan, that is Imam Askari alayhi salam, did not have any other child. So another witness of one of the prominent Sunni scholars regarding the fact that Imam Askari alayhi salam had a son. I refer to the statement of another Sunni scholar, Shevlanji, in Nur al-Absar, page 342. Again, he has a chapter talking about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, Muhammad ibn Hassan al-Khalis bin Ali al-Hadi. He refers to the name of the father of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and his grandfather and his name, that is Muhammad. And also he talks about the mother of the Imam. He says that his mother was a lady who was called Narjis. This is in Nur al-Absar, page 340. As you see, these are some of the prominent Sunni scholars who have witnessed about the birth of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam to Imam Askari alayhi salam, about the existence of a person who is called Muhammad and he is the son of Hassan, that is Imam Askari alayhi salam. So to claim that all the scholars of history and genealogy, they reject the existence of a son for Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, is baseless.
That was Dr. Murtaza Karimi. He has PhD on Islamic theology. He has spoke about doubts and misconceptions on Mahdi's existence. We finish our today's program. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next program.
In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. O Allah, protect your representative, Al-Hujjah bin al-Hassan, Imam al-Mahdi, and send salutation upon him and his ancestors, now as well as all the times. Be his guardian, protector, guide, and assistance. Help him in his path and be watchful for him till you let him rule over the earth willingly and cause him to live in it for a long time.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
around the world with reporters.
Meet Alborz, Iran's latest long-range radar that can detect any hostile aerial object in any given altitude. The Iranian domestically developed radar can track 300 targets at the same time, within a range of 450 kilometers. The high-tech equipment was unveiled on the occasion of the National Air Defense Day.
Alborz radar system is produced by our experts in Iran. It is capable of tracking any air target in high, medium, and low altitudes. Nothing can escape from this powerful radar, and even radar-evading aircrafts would be caught in the net of this advanced new radar.
Alborz radar was unveiled along with over 80 other indigenously built military hardware. Iran says the new equipment will significantly boost Iran's capability in electronic defense. And this, they say, was achieved despite all-out sanctions imposed by the U.S. against Iran's defense sector.
Despite all the restrictions and sanctions imposed on our country over the past four decades, we have managed to turn the threats into opportunities and build up our own arms arsenal. And the wide range of military hardware that you witnessed today are a result of the pressures imposed on us by our enemies.
The National Air Defense Day marks the formation of the Islamic Republic of Iran's air defense as a separate force in 2008, when it split from the country's air force. The military force says it possesses all the essential arms needed to defend Iran's skies, and 100% of the equipment, they say, are made indigenously. Iran's air defense says the country's skies are safer than ever with its homegrown military equipment. Officials here say they owe this to four decades of U.S.-led arms embargoes that have prompted Iran to stand on its own feet and become self-sufficient in the defense industry. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The German foreign minister is the first top diplomat from a European country to visit Islamabad after Kabul fell to the Taliban. Heiko Maas arrived in the Pakistani capital hours after the U.S. forces ended their 20-year war in Afghanistan. The situation in the war-torn country was the main talking point during talks between the German and Pakistani foreign ministers. Pakistan, that shares a 2,600-kilometer-long border with Afghanistan, is concerned about the further instability in its neighboring country. The Pakistani foreign minister has this message for the world to avert yet another crisis in Afghanistan.
This is a pivotal moment in Afghanistan's history. The international community must remain engaged. Humanitarian assistance must flow. Do not let the economic collapse in Afghanistan take place.
But the German foreign minister linked the future cooperation with the Taliban living up to the promises they have made with the international community.
It is important for us that all Afghans, even those who do not support the Taliban, feel represented by this government, and it remains to be seen whether the Taliban take this into account.
Germany was part of the U.S.-led alliance in Afghanistan, and hence the German foreign minister was asked what lessons the West should learn from their defeat in Afghanistan. During the press conference, the German foreign minister conceded that the experiment to impose a specific form of government through military intervention was unsuccessful in Afghanistan. For him, the lesson for the West is that military intervention is not suited if it is meant for exporting and imposing a certain system on the foreign soil. As the U.S. finally ended its military campaign in Afghanistan, there are questions now about the future of Afghanistan. The Taliban may be celebrating the victory over the U.S., but their real test has only begun. Kamran Yusuf, Islamabad.
So far, largest COVID vaccination center in east of Iran. Based in the northeastern city of Mashhad, the medical facility has the capacity to inoculate a whopping 10,000 people every day. The privately owned facility was launched with the attendance of state officials in Mashhad.
This facility offers the space and infrastructure needed to conduct the vaccination. The vaccines and vaccinators will be provided by the health ministry.
Iran has so far vaccinated roughly 7 million people. That's less than 10% of the population. This as the resurgence of the coronavirus in more lethal forms like the Delta variant has been killing an average of 500 Iranians every day. The new Iranian administration, led by President Raisi, has vowed to import millions of vaccines in the coming months. And Parliament says it's ready to offer any help to achieve this goal.
The president has tasked the foreign ministry with negotiating with different countries over the purchase of 60 million doses of COVID vaccines. We hope that this can be achieved by early October. If this happens, we could vaccinate all of the most vulnerable groups within the next 2 months.
In addition to the import of foreign vaccines, Iran is also trying to ramp up the production of domestically made jabs, such as Coviran, which has so far injected more than 1.5 million doses in the country. Nura and Covpars are among the local vaccines that are expected to hit the market in the next few months.
Figures show that every 3 minutes, one Iranian dies of the coronavirus. And this is not the peak yet. Now, as vaccination is viewed as the ultimate terminator of the pandemic, Iran says it will build more such vaccination centers across the country to speed up the so far sluggish inoculation trend in Iran. Yusuf Jalali from the holy city of Mashhad.
Fury raging in the streets of Pakistan on the International Day of Enforced Disappearances that originated in military dictatorship, but the practice continued in subsequent civilian governments.
Victims' families are outraged at Khan administration's inaction over what they call the state kidnapping. Their only request from the government is to prosecute their loved ones in the court of law and follow the due process if they have breached any law.
The protest was organized by Human Rights Commission of Pakistan.
Today we are here in front of Karachi Press Club. As you know, all from all nations, people are here in different regions of Pakistan. They are demanding for the safe release of their loved ones. I am also a victim of enforced disappearance. My father has been kidnapped by the secret forces when he was on his duty.
First post 9/11 reported cases of enforced disappearances was Dr. Afia Siddiqui, who was kidnapped along with her three children in 2003 from the streets of Karachi by CIA with the help of local secret services.
We arranged combined march, united march, along with Shia missing persons, Hindi missing person, Baloch missing person, Pakhtun missing persons. Victim families are sitting here outside the governor house, and they are demanding that if someone is guilty, then give him a trial, fair and free trial in the courts of Pakistan.
We, the Sindhi and the Baloch and the Shia missing persons, Pashtun missing persons, are protesting here. We held a march from Gora Kabristan to here, our governor house. We are demanding here from the Riyasat that where are our people, where are our workers, where are our nationalists, who are belong with some kind of parties.
Enforced disappearances is a chronic human rights violation in Pakistan, with more than 7,000 complaints of enforced disappearances since 2011, where the real number might be much higher than the official figure. Mohammad Turi, Karachi.
The International Organization for Migration says Yemen is suffering from the world's worst humanitarian crisis, as more than 15 million Yemenis have no access to safe water and sanitation. The organization maintained it reached 2.1 million of those in need of water and hygiene services.
The war and the siege on Yemen have had a significant impact on the water infrastructure and led to the destruction of a large number of water facilities and sewage treatment plants in Yemen. There are actually a large number of Yemenis who do not have access to clean water, but not at this scale.
Health officials say lack of access to sanitation is the main reason for the spread of cholera that killed thousands of Yemenis, including children, since its outbreak in 2016. They said the new figures herald a new wave of cholera if the international organizations keep turning a blind eye to the catastrophic situation in Yemen.
There are many water and sanitation projects which have been suspended, either partially or completely, as a result of the war and siege imposed on our country. Most of the organizations do not remain committed to their pledges. The UNICEF is supposed to provide clean water to Yemenis to prevent from a new wave of cholera epidemic and other diseases such as dengue fever and malaria.
Saudi Arabia, along with its regional allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015 and imposed an all-out blockade on the war-torn country. The United Nations describes Yemen as the world's worst man-made humanitarian crisis.
Millions of Yemenis, including children, are at risk of facing a new wave of cholera since they are unable to reach safe water. This has taken place amid the silence of the international organizations. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Young and old, men and women from all walks of life have gathered on the outskirts of Kashmir's summer capital, Srinagar, to commemorate Yom Hussein, or the Day of Imam Hussein. This is one of the events organized across Kashmir Valley every year during the Muslim calendar month of Muharram to discuss the significance of Imam Hussein's sacrifice to uphold Islamic teachings, truth and justice. The event brings together more than 100 Islamic scholars from different parts of Kashmir.
Imam Hussein's personality cannot be defined. We have tried for the last 1400 years to carry forward his teachings and his values. And with passing time, we have seen more and more people are joining the caravan of Hussein. Imam Hussein is an epitome of greatness, and his sacrifice for Islamic teachings and values teaches the way forward. The first step is unity among Muslims.
The scholars urge the youth to go deep into the pages of Islamic history to understand the sacrifices Imam Hussein made.
Imam Hussein, Muharram and Karbala have a message, and we have come to promote that message. The events of Karbala teaches us to be steadfast. They teach us the values of sacrifice for truth. They teach us not to give up and not to bow down. They teach us how Imam Hussein and his companions won the battle of Karbala, despite losing their lives. Today, 1400 years have passed, and we have carried the events of Karbala in our hearts and will carry it to our younger generation and won't let anyone forget the greatest sacrifice for the humanity.
The Islamic scholars also reminded people of plots being hatched by enemies of Islam and urged Muslims to stay united.
The enemies of Islam intend to divide us across communal lines. The majority of non-Muslims think Shias and Sunnis are at odds. They call Shia Muslims Husseinis and Sunni Muslims Mohammedans. And this is deliberate. It is aimed at creating a rift among Muslims to divide us, to divide our faith. Hussein alayhi salam is Prophet Muhammad's grandson. So how come we are divided? Such conferences aim to enlighten people about the nefarious designs of enemies and to teach the importance of unity among Muslims.
Religious scholars say the Battle of Karbala was a defining moment in the history of Islam that continues to inspire people regardless of their religion. And the real tribute to the martyrs of Karbala would be to follow their path in letter and spirit. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdullahian arrived in Damascus on Sunday. He sat down with Syrian President Bashar al-Assad and discussed with him steps taken by both sides to enhance bilateral cooperation with the aim of reaching a higher level of partnership in economy and trade. In the meeting, Assad reaffirmed that the ongoing cooperation between the two countries had positive results in terms of protecting the interests of the two peoples, mainly in fighting terrorism. Abdullahian, for his part, briefed Assad on the outcome of the Baghdad Cooperation and Partnership Conference. He asserted that Iran will continue to support Syria in fighting all forms of terror, mainly economic terrorism.
Both countries are working on a roadmap to develop relations as well as trade and economic cooperation to tackle the sanctions imposed on them. We discussed the latest developments in the region. Improving economic cooperation between both countries' private sector is an important issue which both sides regard as crucial.
The Iranian official also held a separate meeting with his Syrian counterpart Faisal al-Maqdad. They discussed regional and international developments, saying that foreign presence in the region will not bring security and